Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
scams, logic systems and scams. Now, my last podcast was while driving, and I began to give sort of a little bit of background on my sort of small brush with intelligence. And I gave sort of examples, a bit of a rambles. And this will be a bit more systematic, where I look at what makes a scam and how scams interact with intelligence. That this is not brain intelligence, but the another concept of intelligence and intelligence agency, the central intelligence agency, and people's reactions to it. And the thing that I was looking at is realizing that I'd been trained in a certain level of intelligence gathering, well, sort of almost by diffusion, and I was looking at things differently from people who hadn't had been trained. And so that's an interesting aspect. So let's try and filter some things out. Firstly, there's the process to what I would call from data to strategic systems. A strategic system has a mode of behavior, a strategic scenario, and responses. So that's a strategic system. A bit hard for people to think about because most people identify with it so closely they can't see it. It's sort of almost like living in a world where you've never had a mirror. These people live it so much they can't tell that they're in a strategic system, or they're so committed to it they can't actually get a bit of perspective to it. But let's try and talk about this a little bit way. And people's inability to manage their strategic systems means that they can be enslaved, or they can be tricked, or they can be scammed. So essentially my definition of scamming is a viral hijacking someone's strategic system as such they get led to an outcome that they don't want. Essentially giving money to someone else is essentially a scam. They can undergo a series of processes, exchange of information, and you exchange money to them, and then you get the money, and then they go away, and you realize the information has been fraudulent. It's not been genuine. That's a scam. But let's go back to it, because there's a series of processes why we get to that stage, why we have this vulnerability. So there's sort of certain things like you can actually possibly have a trap for, say, an animal, like a monkey trap, which wouldn't work for, say, a dog or a herbivore. A herbivore wouldn't be curious enough to actually put its hoof in something to release something and get its hand trapped. So a monkey trap is essentially a trap which operates on curiosity. You excite the curiosity of the monkey and its hand goes in and gets trapped. Everything else wouldn't do that sort of thing. A snake wouldn't put its hand in to define something out. It's called, I suppose, a monkey trap. So let's go back to discussion. So there's this hierarchy of ideas. There's data, which may be red, spherical, juicy, 10 degrees Celsius, 56 grams, tomato. And if we put them all together, and then I put a date, 2000 BC, on that thing, that piece of, that is a series of data information. It was all data. But if I put that data all together and connected data, or contextualized data, so sufficient data which is linked, that has context, you'd say, oh, well, that's very interesting. That would be a very dead, dried tomato. I wouldn't be able to eat it. And you'd be justified in interpreting the information. So you can contextualize information, and then information can be low priority, high priority. So you can get any contextualized information. Any contextualized data becomes information, but then we have an information filter, which gives us high priority, low priority data. And of course, there's optical illusions where all the data gets us to believe a certain amount of information. So there's inferential data. You can make inferences from it, therefore it won't be available to me now, therefore. So there's that. So there's data, information, information bound with inferences. So this is so you've got raw information, and then you have gradually filtered information. So this is low priority, high priority information, which can be added together. So if you are burgled, and you realise that, and you've just been burgled, and you hear a door slam and something go far away, you can start to make inferences, information. So it's still going ahead. Now, so you've got inferenced data, inferenced information. A little bit more than that is something which you call inference information. Is getting, if the high grade of that we call intelligence. So that's data with intelligence. So again, it's all these processes are guided. They're not just random processes. They're guided by intent. And so your data and information, which is interpreted, becomes intelligence. And then when intelligence, I could say, is a little bit further, it's data plus meaning plus inferences about the thinking of the person. You make an intelligence. Well, it's you make an inference about a system. So if you gather a temperature and time and location, it becomes information. And then that information, if it tells you about the likely behavior of a system or how the system is behavior. So getting deeper down into it, you've got system behavior. Now, if you want to interact with a behavior, which is your process of doing it, that you can have a natural system and have natural intelligence, i.e. Take the temperature, ground temperature of some water, and notice there's no geological activity, start to measure the radioactivity, you say, oh, look, it's near to an ore body. And that fact was how Roxby Downs, the world's most intense radioactive, richest uranium deposit, was discovered. There's just hot water. It was just too hot. The rock that they were looking at wasn't particularly radioactive, particularly promising, except its temperature is wrong. So this is the information is intelligence to behavior. So when the information is linked into a system model, it becomes intelligence. And so this is where you go. So you can have intelligence, but you can further gain is, say, if someone else is also practicing intelligence, you can look at their interpretation and work out what system, what model they are using. So intelligence about someone's use of intelligence can reveal their intelligence systems, their intent and stuff like that. And in sort of a game theory, a conflict theory, you can actually use what they do to actually pick things up. So this is using the curiosity aspect of it. So I suppose, obviously, I've not directly studied this. I've sort of read about it and had little bits of training here and there. And so what you would tend to do is try and actually look at the disorder. It's sort of secondary aspects of it, but let's go back to it. I'll just go to, say, patrolling. You'd in infantry, you'd patrol around the place, you'd be going through the bush. This is, you know, houses and stuff like that, and you'd suddenly see a backpack in a place where it hasn't been thrown out. It's been placed there for you to find. So one of the things you perhaps wouldn't do is you'd note it, but you wouldn't hang around there a long time, and you definitely wouldn't pick it up. Coming across, because it might be booby-trapped, it's intended to do it. And this is the idea of the understanding that you are not in a virgin place where the intelligence there is not left by animals, it's left by other intelligence animals. So intelligence in a multiplayer environment is a different type of thing. Things are put there deliberately to do it, and the fact that they make ideas to create or shape your intelligence means that you can do something called counterintelligence, which is sort of double agents and all that complicated stuff, and people can get really involved and emotionally involved. But I suppose with all aspects of it, you want this sort of balance between passion and rationality. So if you're extremely hungry, it's going to muck up your food source. You're going to go for say high value food source, which may actually destroy your ability to get food source in the long run. So you've got intelligence and counterintelligence, and this sort of goes back to and all this thinking. Besides the counterintelligence, there's also something called internal intelligence, sort of realizing where you sit in terms of intelligence understanding compared to your environment. So this is something I'm beginning to realize. You might be well trained in intelligence, but everyone around you isn't. So you come back and you say, look, here's this piece of intelligence. They're designed to clearly do this, and no one else will understand you, and they will have a response, which you have to think about, oh, what does this matter mean, and how do I communicate it? Do people have to be educated in intelligence the way I was? So the situation I was talking about previously was a recreation of the First Fleet landing in Sydney Cove, a painting, a reconstruction, an obvious if you didn't know it, was an obvious intelligent plan and something worthy of counterintelligence. And so your counterintelligence would be good if you had a bug and you could be in the room at the time they were planning this and the thinking, and have transcripts and stuff like that. And bear in mind, we actually do have something very similar to that: letters, correspondences, clubs. We're beginning to be able to, if we wanted to run a counterintelligence situation, now people who aren't a favor with the intelligence story will go, oh, it's just information. There's no such thing as intelligence, counterintelligence, and you sort of can't educate someone about the road rules at a road accident. They're concerned about life support and who's doing that and where and why. Or you really have to get people to learn to drive separately, to learn to drive school. It's, you can't really say, look, it's desperate, my wife's about to give birth, I don't know how to drive a car, I'm going to learn to drive a car while I'm driving. So your mind's intent on not the actual academic aspects, it's the actual functional aspects. So a lot of times when you speak to someone about intelligence, it's about a topic that they're very passionate about or they're very polarized on, and they find that in that environment it's very hard to listen to you and understand it. So if this is one of the things, the two aspects of it, is that people are not very used to speaking to an intelligence officer or someone who's working in intelligence. They don't know how to speak to it. Now, to them, to their view, that person is speaking rubbish and they haven't got the skill of simplifying it, whereas it could be the opposite, that they can't, rather than that person being rubbish, that they can't perceive value and they haven't been trained to understand it. So rather than making things unnecessarily complicated, you're making things riskily simple. So it's sort of, it's unnecessarily simple or ridiculously simple. So it's that's something to get about. So when now the thing with this particular painting is that they did pre-drafts of the painting, and you could graphically see how they've changed the painting from one to the other, and it's animated, and you can see before and then what knob they are trying to turn. And the entire aspect is of intelligence and counterintelligence, and the idea of understanding that. Now, the British, unfortunately, didn't understand counterintelligence when they were fighting Rommel, or didn't sufficiently understand it. So what Rommel did was that he got his Panzer Africa Corps at Tripoli, landed at Tripoli, and what happened is that he also ordered people to make, or it may not have been him, but maybe other German commanders, to make wooden tanks. And so what would happen is that initially they let the British fly a close range over to get their intelligence, to feed the intelligence, and then subsequently they kept the British at a greater distance, so they couldn't tell. They could see there's a tank there, let's see a tank exactly the same position, but what happened is the real tank went off and they put the artificial tank there. So the British were duped, they were scammed, this is the entire operation of the scam. You could look at the information. Did I check the information? It's also whether you are particularly savvy enough and have sufficient checks to do it. So and you've got to work out that perhaps I've been scammed. And so one of the things of being scammed is naivety, the belief that no one is scamming you. So this is interesting from another aspect, in that you have a whole lot of hallmarks of being scammed. That is, you're losing money, it's not going as well, people are essentially paying money and not getting the value for it. That will be scamming. Sort of getting back to it, there's sort of two modes of behaviour. So there's... look, if I... locked someone up for a while and then just at a particular time and day put up a noose, got that person up, gagged him, just say, shut up, I'm not listening to you anymore, and just hung him, and I was under a normal system, I would be done for murder. However, if I said that person has cheated the system, he's done a social crime, I'm now allowed to do something else. So this is the idea that you have a group contract, and the group part of the group coercion is that the group can change the way it treats you at a certain point in time. So it's very bad to cheat, but the there is this system where people will really stick to the system and not work out that other people aren't working to the system. So this is the aspect of cheating. This is creating a bubble, a phaser bubble, where the people are basically doing counterintelligence, giving out false signals to keep behaviour the same. It's like a parasite. It's called parasitic behaviour. And so the response to that is that if you've got to make the cost of that extremely, extremely high. But then on turn of that, inside that behaviour system, you are really interested in keeping behaviour exactly the same. To allow basically fundamental transactions or exchange, there has to be a trust system to operate in, and the trust system has to be refined. So a lot of the idea of keeping people's behaviour in line is to just make transactions efficient. So if you make sure that everyone just walks down the street, doesn't speak to each other, if you're in a crowded platform, you don't look at each other, you are reducing the cost. So you're saying you can transact, but your cost of transaction has to be low. And so there's sort of your direct line of things, but there's secondary behaviour, which is sort of minimising the cost. It's sort of like a surcharge on a transaction fee. So you want to go up into a shop and buy something, there's a queue of people behind you. It's not a time to have your life story. It's the reason is to reduce it here. So there's this social pressure to conform your behaviour to enable the transaction, the process to come. And of course, scammers can operate this as well. So if you have actually broken across and fundamentally said, look, I'm breaking the contract here, and I'm going to try and do something else, and then the sort of punishment means the risk sort of pushes things across, you can make it hard. Can you hear that little coil bar in the background? To go along there. So that's the overall thing in terms of the intelligence picture, counterintelligence. And once you do in the regime of counterintelligence, you've got the only people practicing counterintelligence really who would have to bother capturing counterintelligence. It's quite interesting to see a fight between these pest birds and a kookaburra up the top here. I'm going to turn it up to the kookaburra to you here. Oh no, you can't really hear it. It's a bit on and off. The only people practicing counterintelligence are scammers and people who are interested in a completely new way of operating. So essentially, people who are actually above the system. And so you're in the company of scammers, but in the essence, as far as the people who are within the status quo, they can't tell the difference between a new way of doing something and a scam. It's the same way of looking at it. So I've discussed that. Well, and that's 22 minutes. Thanks for listening.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.